I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a stunning discovery in a new study that the life expectancy of many American women is stuck or has decreased. But first, the CIA is screening a video for key members of Congress today. It shows North Koreans working inside what's said to be a Syrian nuclear plant before that plant was bombed and destroyed by Israel in a daring raid last September. Until now, Israel and the U.S. have been silent about the bombing, and the video surfaces against the backdrop of 7 years of Bush administration negotiations to try to rein in North Korea's nuclear program. Ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Republican Peter Hoekstra, said after his briefing this morning that the screening happened 8 months too late. Robin Wright is diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. She first reported the existence of this videotape yesterday and joins us today from the Post radio studios. Robin, this tape has reportedly been in Washington circles since before last year's September attack. So why is this tape surfacing now?
That's a good question, and I suspect there are several senators, members of the House, who are going to ask that question today. There has been a pressure mounting since the September 6th raid by Israel on this suspected nuclear facility in Syria for the administration to tell what it knows, to try to clarify both what Syria was trying to do and what role North Korea played, particularly because the United States is engaged at the moment in very serious and sensitive efforts to try to get North Korea to dismantle its nuclear program.
If, in fact, you know, as you say, there's this sort of conflict that some members of the Bush administration are negotiating with North Korea, why would the tape be released to possibly jeopardize those negotiations?
Well, I think there's a real debate inside the administration and in Congress over how far to go with North Korea, how far to trust them. There's been concern, particularly among neoconservatives and some of the harder-line Republicans, about continuing to pay North Korea for fuel. It has not met any of the deadlines that were set for providing information on its past activities and dismantling its facility. And there's a sense among that faction that this is not an initiative that's going to bear fruit. There are others who, within the administration, who want very much to keep trying. This has become a key legacy issue for the Bush administration, which is troubled in terms of its performance on Iraq and what it'll be able to achieve by the end of the year, troubled on Arab-Israeli peace and what it will be able to achieve by the end of the year. And that leaves North Korea as the one bold major initiative still on the table.
Well, we said that the tape shows North Koreans working in this plant that is almost an exact replica of the plant that was in North Korea. What are experts who have looked at this tape telling you that they see in this tape?
I was told this morning that the videotape may actually be of stills. And the question is whether those stills were taken from a videotape.
Right.
Or were they taken inside? But there is a videotape, I know, because Congress was asked yesterday to provide audiovisual equipment, and the source told me that he was sure it was not to show a Julia Roberts movie. But from what I'm told, it shows the same physical configuration as the North Korean facility at Yongbyon. It also has the same number of fuel rods and control rods, and that one expert told me that it's very, very damning information, and U.S. officials say it bears a remarkable resemblance to a facility in North Korea that is capable of producing fuel for a nuclear weapon.
But you also spoke with David Albright, who's a former UN's weapons inspector. He expressed some skepticism that the reactor that's shown on the pictures in Syria, that's now gone, was part of an active weapons program.
That's a very important point. The CIA, I am told, is going to tell the senators and members of Congress that it was not fully functional. There was no trace of fuel, and that now that it's destroyed, Syria does not have a capability any longer.
What are the Syrians, by the way, saying about all this?
Oh, the Syrians are denying it. I did an interview with the deputy foreign minister last fall during the Annapolis peace effort, and he claimed that it was just a military facility. I talked to the Syrian ambassador yesterday who said this was trumped-up evidence and that it is yet again like the eve of the U.S. intervention in Iraq when the U.S. produced evidence that did not pan out in terms of proving weapons of mass destruction.
Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the recent book Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Robin, thanks for talking to us about your story today.
Thank you.
A report issued this week on life expectancy, one of the barometers of a nation's health, held a shocking finding. For the first time in decades, pockets of Americans, most of them women, are not living longer than their predecessors. In fact, the Washington Post points out this is the first time this has happened in the U.S. since the flu outbreak of 1918. Other commentators have compared it to the health decline after the fall of the Soviet Union or the AIDS crisis in Africa. But this is America. Researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health and the University of Washington crunched Census Bureau numbers and federal health statistics from 1961 to 1999 and determined the mortality rate of counties. And they found that the life expectancy for women in 1,000 American counties is now shorter than it was in the 1980s. Why is this happening? Can it be reversed? And what does it look like to people in the health trenches? We'll speak to a caregiver in a minute. But Majid Azadi is co-author of the study, which was published this week in the online journal Public Library of Science. He's also Associate Professor of International Health at the Harvard School of Public Health and joins us in the studio. Dr. Azadi, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
Give us some of the numbers. We know life expectancy for Americans has been tracking up. So give us a sense of that, would you, and then the decline that you saw.
So over a period of about four decades, starting from 1960 to about year 2000, life expectancy for American women went up from just over 73 years to close to 80 years. So it actually went up by over 6 years.
That's terrific.
Exactly. And for men actually have traditionally had lower life expectancy than women in most countries, including in the U.S. For men, it went up from about 67 years to about 74 years, so about 7 years. So there is actually some evidence that men are catching up. The question that we wanted to look at is, well, how much does this gain vary in different parts of the country? And, why is it that men are catching up?
And you found what?
Well, the results were actually very surprising to us. I mean, we found that there are a lot of disparities in the country, and the disparities were actually shrinking for a period of about two decades in the 1960s and 70s. But something happened in the early 1980s that the disparities went up. So it actually became a more inequal situation in the country. The troubling part of the study was that the disparities are going up not because, everybody is going up, some people just faster than the others. It's actually because the people who are at the bottom or near the bottom of life expectancy are not getting better or getting worse off.
And can you put a number on that? I mean, how many years are being shaved off the lives of these women in particular?
Well, those that are getting worse are getting worse on average about 1.3 years. And again, to put this in perspective, over a 40-year period, all the gain for American women was about 6 years. So 1.3 is actually pretty large. It's about 25% of the gains that American women as a whole made in these counties are actually lost.
You saw these declines in the Deep South, along the Mississippi River, Appalachia, lower Midwest, extending into Texas, and for women in particular, the Rocky Mountain area, and a county in Maine. The overarching factor, can we assume that it's income?
Income has been associated with sort of health performance in study after study. So it's got to be a factor, but it is probably not the only factor here. There are other studies that show that people of the same race, of the same income, depending on which part of the country they are living in, they have different health experiences, which must mean that there is something associated with the way that we implement policies, we deliver interventions, we run our health system, that varies across country, that must be affecting people's health above and beyond their own income.
Well, and we should say further that there's a terrible statistic in the report about men, that those men that did not see their life expectancy increase, on average it had to do with HIV or homicide. But with women, it was what?
Well, for women, it was chronic diseases. It was things like increase in lung cancer, increase in diabetes. And again, another result of the study that was somewhat surprising is the fact that something that we had been doing extremely well for two decades, which is reducing cardiovascular deaths from heart disease and stroke, the bad things like lung cancer were going up, so the whole picture turned around and it became from a net gain to a net loss.
We understand the most dramatic change happened in southwestern Virginia. We want to bring into the conversation Helen Robinson. She's a nurse practitioner at the Free Clinic of the New River Valley. That's in Christiansburg, Virginia. It serves two of the counties where women's life expectancy has declined most dramatically. Helen, you've just been listening to Dr. Azadi. Have you seen these health issues at your clinic?
Most definitely. I would venture that obesity and diabetes and hypertension and other cardiovascular problems are our top five or six.
How are you responding to this headline?
With surprise, and yet we're motivated more than ever on a one-by-one basis to work with these patients who have such a difficulty with obesity and smoking and diabetes and management of their lives. And lots of it does have to do with economics, but I agree with Dr. Azadi that there are more factors involved than that. I would say rural status, difficulty getting to and from services would be a very large factor for us. And I find women are more and more taking on not only the child care roles, the grandmother role becomes the mother role, and they're also taking care of their parents.
Yeah.
And so these women are, I think, traditionally putting themselves last and not getting these services due to the fact that so much rests on their support of the people depending on them.
But Dr. Azadi, it would seem that you look at these problems, the lung problems from caused by smoking, obesity from diet, diabetes. Yes, Helen speaks of women in particular not being able to get to the clinics in rural areas or having, you know, to take care of so many other people. But these are health problems that can be reversed.
They can not only be reversed, they actually have been reversed successfully in many parts of the country in the past. Obesity has arguably been harder to deal with, but smoking and blood pressure have been controlled extremely successfully in the United States or in parts of it, so there are really no reasons why our broad health system, whether it's through issues of healthcare access and delivery that Helen mentioned, or through other forms of intervention, regulation, more broad education, pricing of things, should not be able to deal with this. We have done it over and over, and it just doesn't seem to be getting to the people who need it the most, and especially in the past couple of decades.
Helen, your clinic is free. You serve low-income residents who don't qualify for Medicaid. They're not poor enough for Medicaid, but they also can't get insurance. By the way, is this in part because their jobs don't cover their insurance? I mean, why aren't they insured?
They're not insured, I see, for two reasons. One, they work, and if their job provides an insurance policy, it's very expensive. And then the other would be they have jobs that are not full-time or jobs that do not provide insurance.
Where are some of the places that your patients tend to work?
Factories. Walmart, lots of them work at stores, lots of fast food jobs, and traditionally those don't give 40 hours.
That's Helen Robinson. She's a nurse practitioner at the Free Clinic of the New River Valley in Christiansburg, Virginia. We've also been talking with Majid Azadi, co-author of the new report that shows life expectancy for some American women, including Helen's patients, is falling or standing still for the first time in decades. So what else is going on here? Could processed food be part of the problem? We're going to have more. And later, Blackwater's international reach, hiring former soldiers from foreign countries to work alongside American troops in Iraq. That's later. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more about that study published this week that found that pockets of American women across the country have seen their life expectancy decline or stand still. Majid Azadi of Harvard School of Public Health was co-author of the study. He says while other developed countries have seen life expectancy shorten briefly after a crisis, this is the first decline over a period of time, two decades, for a developed country. We're also speaking with Helen Robinson, a nurse practitioner at the Free Clinic of the New River Valley in Christiansburg, Virginia. She covers two counties noted in the study where the life expectancy of women has declined most dramatically. And Helen, you were saying your clients don't have great insurance, if they have it at all. Many are women who take care of other people. They don't have time for themselves. Will this report help you in trying to get them to pay attention to themselves?
Sure. We had a staff meeting this morning before coming to the phone here, and I informed the staff of this status, and everyone is more than ever just very determined to try one by one to have more education, more available services, maybe more frequent visits back to show that progress is being made. I just feel like we have just more work to do now than ever.
If I can add to what Helen said, I mean, I think Helen identified a few issues that really are going to be central to resolving this issue. One of them is obviously financial access to care. But I think the other issues that came up are mere physical access. How far is the nearest health center? And then do people have time? Are they taking care of their families? Are they taking care of their parents and children? And how does that affect their physical access? And I think the other one that we should pay attention to is that all of this put together still requires, you know, something that's sort of about quality of care that people are receiving. So again, you know, we are hearing about the clinic in Virginia that is talking to people about their hypertension status, obesity status. You know, is that something that sort of, you know, the healthcare system is providing? Are people being tested elsewhere, you know, regularly for blood pressure? Are they being sort of, you know, given counseling about smoking? And once they step away from the clinic, you know, are the foods that are supposed to be better for them, at the right price? You know, is tobacco being controlled properly enough that they are not facing advertising day after day? So the issue of health insurance alone will address some of the problem, but there will have to be some level of rethinking of our overall health system and what we care about through the set of clinics that we are hearing about and what happens outside the clinic for people to get there and to be able to implement the advices after they leave.
Well, Dr. Nguyen, it occurred to us as well, for anyone who might be feeling either smug or, you know, just relieved that this horrible statistic is occurring in what seem to be lower income counties. It occurred to us that this may be the tip of the iceberg, because these counties that have shown up to have the shortened life expectancy seem to be uniformly of the same income across the board. In urban counties, there may be a wealthier population that's pulling up the average for the county, masking the people, many more Americans, whose life expectancy is shortened.
This could be an indication of larger issues, and also an indication of what may well be happening for the few years after these and the years to come, that, you know, is it spreading to even more counties, that things are just getting to a point that the nation as a whole is not going to move along because so many of its counties, so many of its people will not improve.
Well, according to a study by the Congressional Research Service, this was last September, the U.S. spends more money on health care than any other country in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's the OECD, a group of 30 or so democracies, countries like Italy, Mexico, Turkey. Most of the countries, though, are wealthy Western countries, and per capita, in the U.S., spending was more than double the average of those countries. So, you know, what's the disconnect?
Well, we believe, and I think we and other researchers are looking into this, that the performance of the country as a whole is being affected because we are not reaching the worst off. Presumably the difference is that the delivery of all kinds of health interventions, whether it's through the formal health care system, whether it's through public health, must be substantially more inequal here than it is elsewhere, and at times it's substantially probably less efficient in terms of the set of things we should be thinking about that affect, again, people's hypertension, obesity, smoking, and so on.
Helen Robinson, again there in Christiansburg, Virginia, you said you pulled your staff together to use this report to revitalize your efforts to get them, you know, to get better care to women in particular, but are you going to tell this statistic to your patients?
Yes, I am. And I'm going to tell them that on a one-by-one basis, we can change this. And each person, if they make the correct choices that we're trying to get them to do, it will definitely impact the results that they will see down the road, maybe not a day at a time, but maybe a month at a time when it comes to things like weight loss and smoking cessation. But once again, you know, it's that choice that they make when they leave the clinic. What do they buy at the grocery store? What do they buy when they go out? Do they get that pack of cigarettes? And I'd say old habits die hard.
And I just want to have said, you know, you mentioned the personal responsibility aspect, but we've reported here on the program that cheaper food is less healthy for you.
Correct. You know,
filled with corn syrup and fructose, and it's a hard decision sometimes for families to make.
You're absolutely right. There is certainly a part of this that is personal, but even that can be improved by having better health system that actually reminds people, as we hear from Helen, about their sort of, you know, personal lifestyle issues over and over, and sort of tells them what the better choices are, and then they should be given the opportunity to actually implement those choices in, because of, you know, through economic and other factors.
You're talking about health policies that better regulate what goes into the foods and how affordable it is and things like that.
Sure. I mean, we have pricing and we have regulation available to us as policy tools. And there is no reason when it's affecting the health of so many people in the United States, we should not be using those tools. And you know, things such as the amount of salt that goes in packaged or prepared food, things such as, you know, various trans fats or other things that might be in foods, those are things that can be handled through various policy options.
That's Majid Azadi, co-author of the study published this week in the Public Library of Science. For a link, you can go to our website, here-now.org. The study had the shocking finding that pockets of women in the U.S. are actually seeing their life expectancy shortened. Dr. Azadi is Associate Professor of International Health at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Azadi, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Helen Robinson is a nurse practitioner at the Free Clinic of the New River Valley in Christiansburg, Virginia. Helen, thank you so much as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, still ahead today, another story we didn't think we'd see in our lifetime. Food rationing in the U.S., but why is Costco rationing rice? We'll tell you. That's after the news, here and now. Congress is considering legislation to prevent federal contractors from avoiding payroll taxes by hiring American employees through offshore shell companies. The bill was filed after the Boston Globe reported that Kellogg, Brown & Root, KBR, avoided paying hundreds of millions in Social Security and Medicare taxes for American employees working in Iraq by hiring them through Cayman Island shell companies. Well, an article in this month's Mother Jones magazine opens a window on one of these companies and the sometimes less than savory characters who work for them. It's a private security firm called Greystone, formed by Blackwater CEO Eric Prince in 2004. Now, Greystone contracts people who have connections to paramilitary groups in foreign countries to help them attract military talent. These people are known in the trade as briefcase recruiters. Mother Jones associate editor Daniel Schulman co-wrote the story. And Daniel, we feel we know about Blackwater. You know, before 9/11, it had less than $1 million in U.S. government contracts. That soon grew to $600 million in 2006. And the State Department just renewed the contract despite an FBI investigation into that incident last year in Baghdad when Blackwater guards killed 17 Iraqis. So we know Blackwater, but tell us more about Greystone Limited and how it fits into Blackwater.
Well, sometime in 2004, there were discussions within Blackwater about the future of its business, and it was decided that while Blackwater would focus on domestic federal government contracts, Greystone would be its international branch. This company was going to focus on foreign government and corporate clients. The idea was that it would offer a range of services similar to the ones that Blackwater offers.
Security
training. Training, mm-hmm. Canine.
But you write that Greystone has now become Eric Prince's, again, the CEO of Blackwater, Eric Prince's primary recruiter of foreign military muscle. How so?
Before Greystone was incorporated, Blackwater had contracts with a particular Chilean firm that was providing Chilean commandos who would work on contract for Blackwater in Iraq. Once Greystone was founded, it began to shift those contracts over. Basically, what had happened is that as profit margins in this private security area began to slim because there are so many companies competing for these contracts, a lot of these firms had to look outside the U.S. for contractors, and there was a big recruiting boom in Latin America where, you know, as opposed to paying a U.S. private security contractor $10,000 a month, you could get a Peruvian contractor for as little as $700.
Well, so in other words, Greystone in some cases is hiring foreign soldiers, and many of these are former soldiers in whatever country they're hired from, to do the business of the U.S. government in Iraq.
Yes, in some cases that's true. If you talk to many of these firms, they will say their third country national guards only guard static sites and are not going out guarding convoys. But we've certainly talked to people that have gone out on patrol and were engaged in instances where they did discharge their weapons.
Well, you introduce us to a Chilean-American businessman named Jose Miguel Pizarro. He says he was told by Blackwater President Gary Jackson, this is a respectable company. We're going into a war zone. I need professional commandos, not peasants with rifles. How does he factor into this story?
Jose Miguel Pizarro is a highly charismatic guy, a real opportunist, and In 2003, he was working for CNN Espanol out of Atlanta. He befriended an army general there who kind of gave him the idea that it might be worth his time to start a business recruiting foreign military talent for private military contractors. He secured a meeting with Eric Prince. Eric Prince said, go for it. Let's see what you can do. Basically, over a period of 3 years, he provided Blackwater, Greystone, and Triple Canopy, which is another private military company, on the order of 1,200 former Chilean commandos to staff their contracts.
What does Blackwater or Greystone say about all of this? Why aren't these mercenary armies?
Eric Prince has always kind of skirted the issue. He said during his congressional testimony in September that we are Americans working for America. That's not the definition of mercenary. The actual definition of mercenary is professional soldiers who are working for a foreign power. And under that definition, Greystone and Blackwater certainly have mercenaries who are working for them.
What are the questions being asked about this process?
Are some of these soldiers, do they have histories of human rights abuses? But also there are questions about the way that these companies are treating these former soldiers. The UN's Working Group on Mercenaries has reported a litany of human rights abuses that have befallen these guys. I think the most important question is, to what level is the State Department aware of the quality of contractor that they're getting? You kind of get what you pay for.
You profile one of these briefcase recruiters who goes out and rounds up these men. He's Julio Nayor. He's a Cuban-American. He's currently serving a sentence in a federal prison in Miami for drug trafficking. He was an associate of the Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar. But prior to that, he was recruiting workers for who?
It seems as if he was recruiting workers for a Salvadoran firm called Capros, which was working for Greystone. In late 2004, he owned a karaoke bar in San Salvador and basically had advertised for positions in Iraq and advertising large sums of money. Guys flocked there and lined up around the corner. Now, Nayor was eventually arrested for plotting to assassinate El Salvador's president.
So there's a chance that someone who was accused of plotting to kill El Salvador's president, who also was an associate of a drug lord, who's serving time in a federal prison in the U.S., was recruiting men to work alongside U.S. troops.
Yes, it's likely that some of these men did work alongside U.S. troops.
You know, I'm wondering, Dan, if another question that's coming up is, this is a huge industry now. As we said, $600 million a year in government contracts. That's just with Blackwater. And, of course, Greystone is a part of Blackwater. It's a huge company. We've reported on how they have aircraft and training campuses. It's an industry that needs to be fed. As the war in Iraq inevitably winds down, what does that company do to feed itself?
You have started to see companies like Blackwater and Greystone focus on peacekeeping and humanitarian aid. They see a huge market for their services in Africa, Darfur particularly. They think that if the UN is not going to step up, why can't they be hired to come in with a light infantry force and take care of the situation there? On its website, one of the services that Greystone specifically advertises for is peacekeeping. They say they can deploy an infantry force anywhere in the world on a moment's notice.
So Blackwater has the potential for sort of operating as its own country, if you will. But is there fear that Eric Prince seems to be, he's called by his friends a patriot, but is there concern that they might hire their services out to another country, perhaps not a friend of the U.S., just to keep the industry going?
I guess that's always in the back of people's minds. It would seem to me, and I know to Eric Prince has expressed this as well, that it would be a little bit silly for him to do that just because it would impact his federal business if he worked for, say, you know, an extreme example, North Korea. That would basically end his federal government contracts. What he says is that they will only work with friendly countries and only then with approval from the U.S. government.
But still, as a freelancer.
Yes.
Daniel Schulman, associate editor for Mother Jones Magazine. He co-authored the story about private security firms in this month's issue. You can link to it on our website, here-now.org. Daniel, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, Virtual War, we'll go inside the minds of gamers, people who play those online role-playing games like World of Warcraft and EverQuest. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Is there a run on rice in the U.S.? Rice shortages did lead to rioting recently in third world countries like Haiti, Senegal, and Pakistan in the last few weeks. But now the two largest warehouse stores in the U.S., Costco and Sam's Club, are rationing rice, limiting how much a customer can buy, saying customers have been stockpiling rice. The price of long grain rice futures hit an all-time high in the Chicago Board of Trade yesterday as traders responded to news of the rationing. Jennifer Waters is consumer editor for MarketWatch.com. Jennifer, first of all, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says the U.S. will produce about 8 million tons of rice this year, and Americans will only buy about half of that. So what's going on? Is there a rice shortage here?
No, there is no rice shortage here. And we're told that again and again by the trade groups that there is no rice shortage in the U.S. But the cost of rice is going up. It's up in the last 3 months alone. The cost of rice futures, for example, is up some 118%.
Well, that's a lot. So is it going up in the same way that grains have gone up just because of world demand?
Yes, exactly. It's, you've got, for example, wheat is going up, has gone up some 95% in the last 3 months. It's starting to trickle down a little bit, but we've got some really, really high prices on commodities. In fact, all-time high prices on commodities. And that's really what's kind of getting people here in the U.S. concerned. If you look at what's going on, say, at Costco and Sam's Club, like them limiting these bags of rice and in some cases flour and oil, you see them doing that. You have to remember that those two stores really cater to small businesses. And so you've got small businesses going in there trying to stockpile it as a hedge against rising prices. So it's not so much the shortage per se, it's them trying to stockpile to keep their costs in control.
These are restaurants and small stores that depend on rice. Well, exactly what are the limits the stores are placing on rice sales?
Well, right now Sam's put in a 4-bag per customer limit, but we're talking about 20-pound bags. So, you know, you don't have to worry that you're going to go to the grocery store and not be able to, you know, get your Uncle Ben's rice. You'll be able to buy that. There's a limit on imported rices like the yasmin or basmati, the long grain. Costco has a 1-bag limit on rice right now, but it's only in certain states and areas. In California, for example, because there seemed to have been a bit of a run on it, they had a 1-bag limit based on what your buying patterns have been. But they don't have that in New York, for example. They have a little bit of a limit on oil and flour in New York.
Well, how much is this self-fulfilling prophecy? You say people who own restaurants are stockpiling to avoid the higher prices they think are coming. But could that possibly create a shortage?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the Costco CEO has been quoted as saying that, they really are trying to limit this fear of there being a panic on a food shortage because of what's happening around the world. But limiting food obviously kind of incites a fear of its own, like, oh, wow, if you can't buy this. So it could become, as you say, a self-fulfilling prophecy, but there are no shortages at this point. Certainly that's what we're being told and being assured. But the prices are rising, and that's what's really getting people concerned. I mean, these prices are just skyrocketing.
When I said self-fulfilling prophecy, I was speaking on the part of consumers, you know, maybe buying it to sort of hedge their bets against the higher prices, but in buying it, creating the shortage, not in the stores, you know, rationing it, creating the shortages. Is what Costco and Sam's Club are doing seen by the market as being a smart move to help prevent a shortage?
Well, yeah, and you're talking to supply and demand. Is there enough supply to reach this demand that seems to be almost self-inflicted, for example? And, from what they're telling us, that, yes, there is enough supply out there. They just want to make sure that people aren't, you know, overly hoarding it, for example, because of the fear of rising prices. But, of course, that is an issue. I mean, our market operates on a supply and demand theory, and if we have people out there buying, hoarding things and taking away the supply and building demand at the same time, that could become a problem. This point, I think it's very premature.
How unprecedented is this, by the way, for a retailer to ration food in America?
We haven't seen this in our lifetimes ever. I mean, there was a food crisis in the 70s, for example, that you might remember, but it wasn't hitting us like that, so we've never seen this.
Jennifer Waters, consumer editor for MarketWatch.com, talking about rice rationing at Costco and Sam's Club stores. And by the way, Sam's Club is a division of Walmart. This is not the Walmart chain that's rationing rice. Jennifer, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, when we come back, going to the movies to watch the opera. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Classical opera should be available to more people. That's the thinking behind the Metropolitan Opera Company's Live in HD Cinemacasts. Now winding up the second season, these live performances are beamed by satellite to hundreds of theaters around the world. Spectrum Radio's Gene Kumagai reports on the technology behind the scenes.
The Italian tenor Marcello Giordani spots the blonde-haired soprano Carita Matilla from across the stage. He's instantly smitten. It's the opening act of Puccini's breakthrough opera, Manon Lescaut, and the couple's voices soar and intertwine as their love ignites with a sudden spark. If Giordani looks a bit weathered to be playing an impassioned young student, and if Matilla is perhaps a little mature as the innocent country girl, the audience doesn't seem to mind. Nor does the audience seem to care that the singers, the orchestra, and the elaborate scenery may be many miles, if not an entire continent, away. Most performances at the world-renowned Metropolitan Opera are done for the benefit of the few thousand ticket holders who fill the company's gilded auditorium at Lincoln Center in New York City. But today's show is being seen live by nearly 100,000 people all over the world. Video cameras and microphones in the Met's Opera House are capturing the singers' every move and note, and satellites are beaming those signals in high definition and digital surround sound to more than 600 motion picture theaters in 11 countries on 4 continents.
Camera 1 is next, step by 1. And magic,
pulling together these high-definition cinema casts is as much a technical triumph as an artistic one. Mark Shubin is a TV engineer who's been masterminding broadcasts at the Met for more than 30 years, including the Live in HD series.
We're delivering in high definition around the world, where they speak different languages and have different television standards. And so we need to convert our signals to the standards that are used in each individual country. And we also need to provide subtitles in the appropriate languages without having to use a different channel for every language that we're transmitting across the Atlantic, because that would very quickly take up all the satellite space that there is. And we'd like people to still be able to make some phone calls while we do our shows.
During a dress rehearsal several days before the actual cinema cast, Shubin and a couple dozen other engineers, directors, and assistants sit inside a large truck stretched along Amsterdam Avenue, just beyond the Met's loading dock. The truck houses a portable TV station, and Shubin intently monitors a huge bank of displays and recording equipment. He's checking that the voices and instruments are all within range, that the sound and video feeds are open, and that everything technological about the otherwise gloriously overwrought performance is calm, quiet, and normal.
Guys, we're getting ready to start here. Okay, we're rolling tapes.
Much like televising a professional football game or an Olympics event, engineering the Met's live broadcasts raises countless technical issues. For example, how to upload audio and video feeds to 7 telecommunications satellites and ensure they arrive in good shape at the other end. What to do if clouds or rain disrupt a satellite signal. How to shoot in extremely low light and frame the shot so that it's as pleasing on a 60-foot-wide cinema screen as on an iPhone. The list goes on. Shubin says the dress rehearsal provides one last chance to iron out any remaining technical kinks.
One of the things that has come up already, we need an optical image stabilizer for one of the cameras, and there was some confusion with the manufacturer, and so instead of sending it to us, they sent it to CBS at the Masters Golf Tournament, except that the CBS people had already left there. And so nobody quite knows where the stabilizer is at the moment, but we're assured that we will get another one in time for Saturday's show.
On the day of the performance, a crowd at the sold-out Walter Reed Theater watches the Puccini drama unfold. The theater is just across the street from the actual opera house, and so they could have easily seen the performance there. But besides saving a couple $100s on a ticket, the CinemaCast has its own special appeal, says opera buff and former U.S. ambassador to Sierra Leone, John Hirsch.
What you get here are the close-ups and this wonderful photography that augments the wonderful music, and the quality of the sound is terrific. And, of course, most people are not in New York City, so they're around the world, and that's a great contribution, I think, to the world of opera.
The CinemaCast performance is indeed distinctly different. When the cameras zoom in for a close-up, you can see even the subtlest expression or gesture. Although the performers are valued for their golden voices, it's clear they're also accomplished actors. Only the first few rows of the opera house enjoy such a privileged view.
Give me a brioche and a bottle of water.
During intermission, the cameras go backstage and show singers warming up and changing costumes. The 47-year-old Carita Matilla explains how she prepares for such a youthful and physically demanding role.
So I've done my share of yoga this morning, and, you know, it's just, I've never done dancing, but it must be then I have to do, because I'm 47, I have to do the other side.
The audience bursts into delighted laughter as Matilla limberly drops to the floor in a forward split. Opera-goer Nancy Tsung says she's seen several of the CinemaCasts already this season, and she's been urging a friend in Chicago to go too.
I spoke to her 2 days ago. I was really encouraging her to see it because she's like really opera fan. She goes to every year. She's in the ring. 2 days ago, she said she will give it a try, so I'm dying to find out.
Peter Gelb, the opera company's innovative general manager, initiated the CinemaCasts 2 years ago, in part to reach new audiences who might otherwise never see an opera.
We will never have, you know, the audience of the Amy Winehouse, but opera is high art, and we're not pretending it's anything other than that. But we believe that this high art form, which has been around for hundreds of years, should be able to be presented to the broadest possible range of the public. And within every social strata and demographic group, there are people who, if given the chance and exposed to this beautiful music and these fantastic performances at the Met Musters, will respond favorably to it.
Engineer Mark Shubin notes that the advanced technology that underpins the CinemaCasts isn't foolproof. Thunderstorms have disrupted the satellite signal. A fire broke out inside one theater mid-performance, and the power can suddenly, inexplicably, fail.
But our audiences have been extraordinary. In one of the theaters that had some major problem, it was either the fire or the power failure, the theater said sorry and refunded everyone's money, but they didn't go home. They just kind of milled around and was, oh, you know, we want to go back in. And when the fire was put out, they went to the theater managers, can we go back in now? Yeah, I guess so. And so they went back in and they watched the rest of the opera.
Even for such a high-tech endeavor, the show must and does go on.
Jean Kumagai in New York for Spectrum Radio, the broadcast edition of IEEE Spectrum, the magazine of technology insiders. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. The final performance in the Metropolitan Opera's second season of Live in HD CinemaCasts takes place Saturday. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.